This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight. This is a special pre-recorded program while VOA headquarters resolves some technical issues. I'm your host, Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up,
ExxonMobil has slowed down on its project in Mozambique. Tullow in Ghana just canceled a contract with Maersk. You have a lot of projects in Nigeria that are being put on hold.
That's Cameroonian lawyer NJ Ayuk, one of Africa's top energy dealmakers, on the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on African oil. Details coming up. Also, health officials in Ethiopia are preparing for the worst in case the pandemic gains a larger foothold. And after years of civil war, South Sudan's transitional unity government is urging citizens to work towards reconciliation. We'll have these stories and more in the special VOA Africa program. And here is our top story. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, says developing countries could lose up to 85% of oil and gas income this year. The global coronavirus crisis, which has caused people in many countries to stay at home, has resulted in a huge drop in demand for energy and halted most energy projects across the world. Darren Taylor has this report from Johannesburg.
Many business experts agree that before COVID-19 struck, Africa's energy producers were preparing for an economic boom.
You had billions of dollars being pumped into oil and gas in Mozambique. That is something that was...
Cameroonian lawyer NJ Ayuk is one of Africa's top energy dealmakers.
You had billions of dollars being pumped into new projects in Senegal. These are two new countries where no one ever thought there's going to be oil and gas, and now they became one of the biggest investment attractors in the continent. You had Nigeria.
Ayuk also chairs the African Energy Chamber and is an advisor to governments and local and international companies on natural resource projects. He says before coronavirus, the continent's leading oil producer, Nigeria, was set to churn out 3 million barrels a day, up from less than 2 million. And the energy optimism didn't end in Lagos. But, says Ayuk, because COVID-19 has basically shut global economies, Africa's potential energy boom is now definite doom.
ExxonMobil has slowed down on its project in Mozambique. Tullow in Ghana just canceled a contract with Maersk. You have a lot of projects in Nigeria that are being put on hold. That's a short-term.
He says energy schemes have stopped across the world.
That's one of the toughest things that, for me, leading the African Energy Chamber, I have to deal with. I'm in constant calls with my counterparts in the United States, in Canada. And when we get employees and we get people on these video conferences and having conversations with us, the one question that I get asked is, will I have my job next week? Can you promise me that I have my job?
Ayuk says it's impossible to make such promises because of the coronavirus meltdown.
It's going to cost a lot of jobs, and that's where it really touches everyday people and their lives, because it's unprecedented what we're seeing right now.
He thinks the crisis will end oil exploration across Africa for the rest of the year.
In Africa, a lot of states which expect rent out of oil and gas and crude sales, they wouldn't be getting that. Nobody is a winner here. We are all losers.
Many African countries who rely on oil based their budgets this year on getting $70 a barrel, but the price has plummeted to less than $30. Ayuk says fuel at the pump will be cheaper, but it will also ignite higher costs elsewhere once the pandemic is over, spelling trouble for manufacturing economies like South Africa. Ayuk says African states that depend entirely on oil to run their countries should be heeding the lesson from the COVID-19 disaster. Diversify your economies. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Most countries in East Africa have only a handful of coronavirus cases so far, but health officials in Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous country, are preparing for the worst in case the pandemic gains a larger foothold. Figures seen by VOA show millions of Ethiopians to be at risk of contracting the disease, while thousands could need intensive care inside a month. Simon Mark reports from Addis Ababa.
The Ethiopian Health Ministry has modelled a worst-case scenario for the country due to what officials fear could lead to a super-spreading event that results in the health system being overwhelmed in a few weeks. Government data produced this week by Ethiopia's health ministry and obtained by VOA outlines a worst-case scenario for Africa's second most populous country, predicting that almost 28 million people in the country are at risk of contracting the virus. The government is planning for as many as 9,700 people to need intensive care in the next 4 weeks. The data also state that as many as 30,000 serious coronavirus cases could arise even if social distancing measures are implemented. Leah Tedessa, Ethiopia's health minister, authenticated the document seen by VOA, but underlined that the government was in the process of updating its numbers. She told VOA via a messaging app that there is a major shortage of intensive care units in Ethiopia.
Based on the evidence so far globally, patients with COVID-19, at least around 5% of them would require ICU support and ventilators. And considering what we have in the current status of the country, even in the cities, we do have a huge gap in terms of numbers of ICU beds and ventilators.
Tedessa said that Ethiopia was in the process of procuring more intensive care units and ventilators, as well as training people in how to use them.
We are hoping to add close to 500 ventilators for the whole country. Currently, as a country, we have around 435 ventilators, mostly in public, some in private. We are preparing for worst-case scenarios. Oh, of course, the exact estimations and modeling exercise is not finalized, but the work is ongoing.
Tedessa would not comment on government projections that up to 1,242 people could potentially die in Ethiopia inside 4 weeks, but noted that the government was working in close cooperation with experts from the World Health Organization, Ohio State University, and consulting firm McKinsey to carry out modelling exercises and arrive at reliable figures. The document seen by VOA also notes that other health emergencies in the country could flare up as the health system shifts to responding to COVID-19. As of Wednesday, these dire predictions remain hypothetical. Ethiopia has only 29 confirmed cases of coronavirus and no deaths. Case numbers remain low in all of Ethiopia's neighbours as well. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
As the number of coronavirus cases in Nigeria skyrockets, the government has taken measures to contain the spread of the disease. Reporter Gift Agariga in Abuja spoke to some Nigerians on the lockdown directive by President Muhammadu Buhari.
In his address to the nation Sunday, Buhari ordered all citizens in the capital, Abuja, and Lagos and Ogun states, the areas with the highest number of cases, to stay in their homes. All businesses, markets, places of worship, and offices within these locations are to remain closed during the lockdown. Some state governors earlier declared a partial lockdown in their states. Many believe that bringing activity to a near standstill will force hardship, especially hunger, on many families, as most people were believed not to have prepared enough for it.
The lockdown really is affecting me. I'm a trader, I sell clothes. Now I can't go to sell my markets. Everything is locked and the government didn't even do anything to help us to sustain ourselves. I'm just staying at home now, idle, doing nothing. Can't move out because of the curfew that has been imposed by the federal government. There's no money to go buy what to eat. Everything is just not easy. I pray that this government, the president, thinks twice on what he's doing and remembers us, the citizen, and put everything right.
I wasn't able to stock up because the police and some government official shut down the market on Friday last week. In fact, I'm not enjoying this at all. Because if you're telling people to stay indoors, at least the basic amenities such as light should be provided. As I speak to you, there is no light. The generator we are supposed to operate in substitute to electricity empty, no fuel. In fact, I don't know how we're going to survive.
I wouldn't really say I stuck my house because it came suddenly. We heard we were going to have a lockdown as a rumor. The next thing, everywhere was locked down. Even the market, you know, everywhere has been totally shut down. One could only do what you could possibly do in your own best ability. As much as I know it's for the best, I didn't like the time frame. I would say we weren't given enough time to get fully prepared for this lockdown.
The lockdown here in Kaduna is really not funny at all. I mean, it's so unfortunate that you have to be confined in one spot for God knows when. The businessmen and women in our society, I think they are the worst hit right now, because if they must survive, they have to go out every day to struggle to make ends meet. But right now, they are being locked up in their houses. Salary earners are not even feeling it. They won't, because at the end of the month, whether they work or they don't work, they get paid. But for business people, you have to struggle. You have to go out on a daily basis to make ends meet. But right now, you're in your house. Me, for instance, I lost my job in December. This January, I just started a business. I'm just trying to find a way to make it work. Right now, I'm being locked up. I'm not used to not having money in my hands. But now I'm being locked up in one place. Honestly, I don't know how. It's so crazy. The way it is in my mind right now, I don't know how I feel. It's so crazy, honestly.
Those were the voices of some Nigerians reacting to the lockdown order. There has also been mixed reaction on whether the president has the constitutional backing to lock down the cities to help check the spread of the coronavirus that is quickly spreading around the globe. A human rights lawyer, Frank Tete, says the president does have the power to impose such conditions.
Now, the process that he adopts matters a lot. With regards to the COVID-19 pandemic and his recent directive that Ogun State, Lagos State, and the Federal Capital Territory be on total lockdown, he is empowered to carry out that directive based on the Quarantine Act of Nigeria in the 2004 Laws of the Federation of Nigeria.
Tete, however, said the lockdown would have been much better with a commensurate set of palliatives for the people.
Nigeria does not have the facilities to sustain a lockdown. The decision to impose a lockdown on a fragile economy that boasts of a large number of the poor, an economy that cannot sustain basic social services, to impose a lockdown would be insensitive.
Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, has recorded 151 confirmed cases and 2 deaths from COVID-19. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga. From Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to a special recorded program on VOA Africa. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, says developing countries could lose up to 85% of oil and gas income this year. Ethiopia is preparing for the worst in case the pandemic gains a larger foothold. And the new South Sudan Unity Government is urging citizens to work towards reconciliation. VOA is experiencing some technical difficulties, so we are offering this program recorded earlier. We aim to return to our normal programming soon. And in the meantime, thanks for listening to African News Tonight. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. After years of civil war, South Sudan's new transitional unity government is urging citizens to work towards reconciliation and forgive perpetrators of violence. Several public and private initiatives are in place to help the South Sudanese people build a peaceful future. But will the measures work in a nation with so many deep scars? Chika Adua reports from the South Sudanese capital of Juba.
31-year-old Junior Dow is sitting in the parlor of his home, gazing at photos of his slain cousin, who was killed as a soldier fighting in the civil war that broke out in 2013. 3 of Dow's siblings also died in the war, and his mother was tortured when rebel fighters dunked her into a water tank.
So my mama was put in there like 4 times. She fainted 4 times. And that is one thing that has made her not to come back to South Sudan again. She hated so much.
After losing so many family members to the conflict, Junior was left with resentment and bitterness towards other ethnic communities in South Sudan.
So I had in mind I only get a gun so that if I get a chance to revenge.
Other South Sudanese have similar feelings. An estimated 400,000 people have died in the civil war, and the violence has left deep scars on the nation, with ethnic communities pitted against one another. In February, rival politicians, President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar, formed a transitional unity government after more than a year of negotiation and delay. Political analysts like Dr. James Okuk of the University of Juba are cautiously optimistic that this power-sharing deal, unlike others, will take hold and allow the nation to begin to heal.
It is a start, but the task is overwhelming, and we hope they will be up to the task, particularly reconciliation, which really require a lot of times, require a lot of efforts. The political leaders in this country have created those grievances by, you know, making the civilian to take sides of these political quarrels. And taking sides has created these enmities among those communities. So with peace coming back now, I think it is time to mend those broken relations.
Mending broken relations is exactly what a recently formed government National Dialogue Committee is trying to do. Dr. Francis Deng, South Sudan's first ambassador to the United Nations and a scholar on conflict management, is putting his expertise to use as a committee member. He says tackling complex issues such as how to administer justice for war-related atrocities will not be easy.
One line of reasoning is let's forgive and forget. That's one line of reasoning. The other line of reasoning is too much harm has been done. People have been victimized, massacres have taken place, crimes have taken place. Here you come to another point of view. The African perspective generally is to try to reconcile, maybe compensate, and not talk in terms of punishment.
The government is now supporting what Deng describes as the African approach towards reconciliation. On the streets of Juba, several peace advocacy billboards display phrases such as, it's time to forgive. At the University of Juba, students meet under a large tree to learn about how to give psychosocial support to those dealing with bitterness. The class is organized by Vivian Peter, a 33-year-old woman who had her own pain to work through after a rival ethnic group gunned down her husband. After his death, she studied psychology and counseling, and now she finds hope and healing in training therapists. She takes a particular interest in helping counsel youth who can easily join militia forces to carry out revenge. She says they are the most vulnerable demographic needing psychological support. Christianity is the major religion in South Sudan, and churches are also making an effort to restore peace. In another part of Juba, young activists have organized an event called Peace Camp. It offers a safe space for young people to talk about the pain of war. The organizer, Lupai Samuel Stephen, was displaced by the war and grew up in Uganda.
So the Peace Camp brings the people together to be able to, like, create relationships on personal levels, you know, so you get to meet somebody from a certain community that you're always looked at as an enemy.
Initiatives like these will not solve South Sudan's greater problems, but activists hope they can make small positive changes and rebuild a nation torn apart by war. Chika Odua for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
Zimbabwe's Supreme Court has issued a judgment that has thrown the country's main opposition MDC alliance into turmoil over the fate of its president, Nelson Chamisa. Adigando gives us more on the story.
The court ruled yesterday that Chamisa is not the party's legitimate leader, saying his ascendancy was fundamentally flawed by gross constitutional irregularities. While acknowledging that the ruling may be moot and academic, presiding Justice Bharat Patel said the leadership question needs to be correctly and systematically corrected. The court was addressing an appeal lodged by Chamisa over a high court ruling on a challenge against his rise to power by a party activist, Elias Mashavira. The court earlier ruled in Mashavira's favor in seeking an order compelling the party to revert back to its 2014 structures. The current leader of the MDCT, Thokozani Kupe, was the vice president before Chamisa was appointed to co-vice president alongside Kupe and Elias Mzuri by the late Morgan Tsvangirai. Chamisa and his then deputy, Morgan Komichi, then appealed the ruling at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ordered that Kupe, as the interim leader following the death of Tsvangirai, convene an extraordinary congress within 3 months to elect new leadership. Komichi, who took over as party national chairman when Love Momoyo resigned, will automatically take over the reins of the MDC if Kupe fails to convene the Congress as per the party's constitution. MDC Alliance Secretary General Charlton Wende speaks on the ruling.
Look, our position is clear that we are the MDC Alliance led by Advocate Nelson Chamisa. The ruling concerning that other MDCT has nothing to do with the MDC Alliance.
But while the MDCT led by Thokozani Kupe appears to concur that the ruling had nothing to do with the MDC Alliance led by Nelson Chamisa, it also maintains that it is acting within its rights, for example, to reinstate the mayor of Victoria Falls amongst a couple of others who had been recalled by Nelson Chamisa's MDC Alliance.
Check what the MOU says about the leader of the alliance. It is clear that the MDCT president is the leader of the alliance. So if that mayor was recalled by his own party, he would not have done anything. But because someone who was masquerading as the MDCT leader, thereby as the alliance leader, also did the action. So we're correcting all of that. So, yeah, we are not confused about our actions. We are very clear what we're doing.
Observers say the judgment further complicates the leadership wrangle within the country's main opposition ranks. Political analyst Efinwe believes it requires further scrutiny on its implications and that the MDC political bickering needs to be put to bed.
But this is a great opportunity for the MDCs to settle this once and for all so that it doesn't continue and linger on and on, destabilizing the party at the end of the day, and then find an amicable way forward.
The Nelson Chamisa-led MDC Alliance has disputed the 2018 election and called for an impartial arbitrator before it can come to the table with the ruling ZANU-PF. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.